Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. It's good to have you with us on this Thursday evening. Graham Kerner with the market report just at about 20 past six. Remember, a couple of weeks ago, he challenged you, particularly if you're in financial services, to plant trees. He's enlisted Food and Trees for Africa, and he wants to challenge financial services players to grow trees in South Africa, especially in deprived areas and areas where there aren't many trees. He's going to lean on you this evening, and you need to be leanable. Warren Ingram and why you must never chase after last year's investment hero. And so often we see people going, oh, last year the ABC unit trust did so well, I must take all of my money and put it into that. And then they wonder why it doesn't perform brilliantly in year 2, 3, 4, and 5. Alon Reyes from Reyes Corp is our small business expert this evening. He was wondering what he should talk about. So I said to him, I'd be interested in the 7 things that are irritating you most. So he went away and he thought about it and then sent me a list. So we'll go through his list. And it's a good list. We'll talk about the European Central Bank and why it is trying to stimulate growth once again in the Eurozone. We'll talk about the record fine for Steinhoff with the big chunk of it off for good behavior. And then some insights into the crime statistics. All of that is coming up this evening on this very latest edition of The Money Show. No, I'm still not working. That's okay.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
It saved me the trouble of breaking into song and you the trouble of having to listen to it. Steinhoff has been fined 53 million rand. False, misleading, or deceptive statements to the market. Now, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority ruled that Steinhoff must pay this 53 million rand. The fine initially, though, was closer to 1.5 billion rand. But the Financial Sector Conduct Authority looked at the retailer's current financial standing and understanding that if they were asked to pay 1.5 billion rand, it would probably see them shipped out in a coffin. 1.5 billion rand is a record fine. Brandon Topham is the Divisional Executive for Investigations and Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the FSCA. Why the discount on this 1.5 billion rand fine, Brandon?
Good evening. There's obviously a number of reasons, but in short, the primary reason would be the affordability of the fine to the company. If you look at the financial statements of the entity right now, you'll see it's actually factually insolvent, and there's just no way it would have been able to pay a fine of 1.5 billion rand. Then we also had to consider the fact that the people that would be ultimately paying the fine are the shareholders who have already lost 98% or more of their investments. So it's almost like a double whammy. But at the same time, we have to remember that it's important for us to deter this type of, shall we say, negligent behavior on the part of entities, and we can't just let them off completely. So even the 53 million would be the highest fine paid yet in South Africa of something of this nature.
I mean, but it's sending a signal, and I'm not sure what the signal is. 1.5 billion rand, it's a record fine. The discount, however, says, well, if you cheat and lie and thieve and you do it convincingly enough and the company still survives, well, then we'll let you off most of the fine. Doesn't it send a dangerous precedent?
Bear in mind that the company itself didn't do this. So the perpetrators behind the actual misrepresentation, they're still on our radar. And we are busy with investigations into that. Their fine obviously will not have the same level of remittance, if anything, when we get to impose a fine there, if we find them in contravention as well. And it's very difficult to think how we wouldn't find someone in contravention if we've already found the company in contravention of that section.
If you concede the company's not at fault, then why impose a fine at all on the company that is cash-strapped and on the bare bones of its backside?
Well, 53 million, there's not very many companies in the stock exchange that would want to pay 53 million rand. It's not a Mickey Mouse fine. It's a serious fine. It is the highest fine as well in the country.
And so, I think you missed the question there, Brandon. Missed the question. You had, there was some interference there for a moment ago. My question was, if you acknowledge that the company was not at fault here for this fine, why fine it at all if that's the case?
Well, the company is always responsible for the actions of its directors. And that's the message we have to send to the market, that when you're a shareholder and you're appointed director, you're going to be responsible for the actions of those directors and employees. And the users of the financial statements rely on those financial statements. So as a separate legal entity, it still has a responsibility. The responsibility, however, we're just saying is not as great as that of the people that actually perpetrated that fraud.
What is the position of the people who perpetrated the fraud? The FM editor, Rob Rose, today writing in the magazine, it's 19 months, I can't believe that, it's 19 months since Steinhoff collapsed. The Hawks seem to be treating South Africa's largest fraud as if it was a mall shoplifting snafu. And there's a very strong perception that white-collar crime gets treated with kid gloves. I mean, that's the last thing I'm sure that you want that message to, that's the last message you want to send.
I can't speak on part of other prosecuting authorities, etc., because we are a regulator. So we can only regulate the entities under our jurisdiction. And I think we're acting very fast. If you consider that the forensic report with the real details of the transgressions only was released in March. And we hope to have all the matters tied up within the next 8 to 12 months against individuals as well. That would be pretty fast, under 2 years. And that would be given administrative penalties and given the assistance to the prosecutors to go ahead with other criminal prosecutions if they so wish.
Brandon, take a deep breath. Just a few more questions. I mean, does it frustrate you that Marcus Huerster is wandering the streets, that he is seemingly contemptuous of the processes and the attempts to recoup money from him?
Well, we've got to approach it from the very neutral stance. So we are in discussion with all the persons that obviously have been named in the report. They're not necessarily just walking the streets. We are corresponding with them and talking to them. And in the end, we can make our decision. At this point in time, as far as everybody is concerned, Marcus Huerster is as innocent as you or I. You know, until the final decision is made, they are innocent of any transgression. But at this point in time, the company has transgressed, and the people behind the transgression are the next in line for, a decision from our part.
And the role that you're going to play in terms of potential prosecution of people behind the fraud. We know there was a fraud. There was 105 billion rand fraud. PwC has told us that in an 11-page redacted report. So we know that there was criminal activity. We just don't know exactly who was involved and to what extent. So what is your role then in bringing this matter to some kind of finality, to bring it to a legal conclusion?
So to the extent that there is fraud, we have no role, unfortunately. We only have jurisdiction in terms of the Financial Markets Act. That means we will only be able to prosecute from our side in a civil manner the insider trading charges as well as the Section 81, which is the false and material misleading financial statements as such. Those come with penalties which are quite substantial, as you can see from the fine we levied today. And then over and above that, we will then open up criminal dockets with the prosecuting authority where they can prosecute it further criminally. We also have offered our technical assistance to help the prosecuting authorities or the Hawks in coming to their conclusions. But we can't prosecute the matter in court, in a criminal court.
I understand that. But the point is, you're gathering the information, you're gathering the data, you are building the dockets, which then get handed over to the prosecuting authorities, whose job then is simply to present that evidence in court as the case.
No, we're building a docket for transgressions of the Financial Markets Act,
okay,
not for fraud.
But fair enough.
It, parts of that docket can be used by the prosecutors in their fraud charges if they proceed with them. But if they don't proceed with them, there are criminal transgressions in any event, which our cases are. So we will push them with the prosecuting authority. In the end, the prosecuting authority decides, do we prosecute for fraud or do we prosecute for transgression of the Financial Markets Act? And of course, the penalties potentially for fraud are higher. They will probably prosecute that and not our offences. But we
thank you. Sorry, Brandon Topham, you are running out of breath. I can hear it. Brandon Topham, Divisional Executive for Investigations and Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. A lot of frustration, and again, it's social media frustration, and I think I do need to start shutting down my social media pages, because a lot of it comes from a point of absolute abject rage and prejudice and, yeah, and the swearing. Oh, my goodness me. You white kangaroo FSCA commission sets a fine of $1.5 billion. And in turn, you make the white criminals only pay $53 million. Swear. Talk about your real white criminals and stop. And then a term for mucking about. I think that that's been quite clearly explained. There are, unfortunately, various jurisdictions that these guys have got. And so as much as I'm sure the FSCA would love to go in guns blazing and to take down people they believe are responsible for these things, they've got to rely on the state. The state is the criminal prosecutor in these matters. So the criminal action has got to be prosecuted by the state. And the case of the fine, initially I looked at it and went, hold on a second, but I'm satisfied with the explanation. If you levy a 1.5 billion rand fine on Steinhoff today, it goes bankrupt. Done. It's over. And then you don't collect 53 million. The underlying businesses then are prejudiced. The people who work for them, the tens of thousands of people who work for these businesses around the world, and they are global businesses, then are under pressure as well, as these businesses then have to be sold in a fire sale. And is that the best solution? No, it's not.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Graham Koerner with a Koerner perspective on the day that the market went up nearly 1%. It was a good solid day, particularly for financials, but we had a bounce in commodity prices. The Rand strengthened. The European Central Bank, and we'll talk about that, has tried to stimulate growth in that economy once again. But before we talk all about that, Graham Koerner, a couple of weeks ago you came on and you begged and you pleaded for a good cause, and you said that you were donating money to Food and Trees for Africa in a challenge that you were laying down to the financial services industry to donate money to make a difference to poor communities to plant trees. And you've not had people falling over themselves.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. I think as at close of business today, we'd raised directly a little over 70,000 rand. Kindly, somebody has agreed to double that, so we're at just under 150,000 rand, which is 750, let's call it, trees thereabouts. But way short of the 5,000 that we're targeting. And I'm hoping that, everybody's just been obsessed with the markets and haven't really got to the pledge pages yet, but that they will come in before the end of September.
Okay, I got a call from Chris Stewart today, because Chris Stewart has people. He's our Wednesday night market commentator from Investec Asset Management. And he's pretty sure that he can get them to agree to 20,000 Rand, which is nice. So we can include that in your total. And that's really good. I mean, the challenge is to people in the financial services industry particularly, but to absolutely anybody who's got some money that they can donate. The challenge is what exactly?
So I think the challenge is ideally, to help offset your footprint, your carbon footprint, by donating on behalf of a number of trees, on behalf of the staff that work for you. But I think the important thing, Bruce, is some people might sort of feel a little overwhelmed and think, you know what, I just haven't got, 10 or 20,000 rand to match these big donations. So I think the important thing is, if there's an issue around logistics, so for example, if your company requires an invoice, then please just contact us and we can arrange a pro forma invoice for you, firstly. Secondly, if a company says, look, we can't do it, we've contributed to Mandela Day or whatever, open it up to the staff. And I think the third thing is don't worry if it's only 100 or 200 rand. In Afrikaans, I say, elke druppelkie fills the bucket. And I think that's the important thing. So, this is not just for big numbers. This is not just for big organizations. And it's not just for companies. Anybody can contribute, whether you're in the financial services industry or not.
I did. And I made a contribution. It was quite interesting. I mean, Investec Asset Management, the team was telling me that they have got, obviously, a business in the UK, and they do tree planting there with people in the Western Cape, because they are Investec Asset Management based in the Western Cape. They team up with a group called Green Pop.
Yep.
And they calculate their carbon footprint and they donate money to offset that. So this is an additional bit of money, courtesy of Chris Stewart on a Wednesday night, which is really good. A positive day for markets, Mr. Koerner?
Oh, it's wonderful, isn't it? People always tell me I'm just, you know, perma bear, and I always want to just stick in cash. But it was wonderful to see quite a bit of green on our screens, off the best levels. We at one point in time we were up, I think, over 1.4%, closing the day 0.8% up. But you know, apart from a handful of you know, the likes of Sasol and BHP and MTN that were down, the rest of the market very, very strong, led by Aspen. I don't know if there was a short squeeze or if people suddenly thought, you know what, the debt is no longer the noose around their neck, but that one was up almost 11%, helping a lot. But a very, very strong day. Financials had a very, very good day as well.
Okay, good day. Calls. Dr. Adrian Saville. There he is. Dr. Adrian Saville is the chief executive of Cannon Asset Managers. Do you still have a checkbook, Adrian Saville? Are you writing a check as we speak?
Evening, Bruce. I think if I scratch around, I probably would find a checkbook lying around somewhere.
Have you got some money for Food and Trees for Africa?
Bruce, I think this is an absolutely fantastic initiative. And I would love to make a contribution. I'm going to go out. Can I use a very corny pun and say I'm going to go out on a limb? And nice. I haven't been listening in on the show. I apologize. But whatever you've pledged, I'm going to match that.
So you're going to pledge what I've pledged?
As I say, I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to.
You have no idea what I've. You have no idea what I've. You have no idea what I've contributed. I'm a very, very generous person. You know this.
I know that, Bruce. And I think this is a fantastic initiative. I'm with you in it.
I will send you the deposit slip. All right. And you're going to have to wait for that till after the show because I have to concentrate. So brace yourself, Adrian Saville, because I had a rare burst of extraordinary generosity. In his personal capacity, Adrian Saville is going to donate some money as well, Graham Koerner. So a little tick there as well. The European, we are doing market commentary as well this evening, not just begging for your indulgence. But the Eurozone, they're really worried about a recession there. And the ECB introducing new stimulus measures. They've already got negative interest rates in the Eurozone. And they are now going to go deeper into negative interest rates to try and get some growth going.
Yeah, Bruce, so cutting rates by 10 basis points, so we're now at minus a half. You really have to stand on your head for that to make any sense at all. But then after withdrawing QE, what, about a year ago or thereabouts, now back on committing 20 billion euros a month. And I think the bottom line is monetary policy can only go so far. The governments need to start spending if it's a sort of a Keynesian economics exercise. And if that doesn't work, it's like, you know, pulling the choke on an engine where you can actually then cause it to flood. So I think it's an exercise in desperation, frankly, and it could very well end up doing what happened in Japan and kind of a lost decade. So I think it's really now up to the policymakers in Europe to say we've got ridiculously low interest rates and we're going to use this to try and kickstart some real economic growth. Otherwise, the engine could stall.
And Paul Theron, Managing Director at Vestact. You're not funny to talk to us about markets, are you, Paul? I hope you're funny to talk to us about money.
Yes, money. I'm a big, big tree lover, and I'm most impressed that Graham has taken this up. So I don't have people. I am the people at Vestact. So we are going to make a contribution of 25,000 rand to your pot. And you know what they say about trees? The best time to plant one is 40 years ago, but the second best time is today. So we're very excited to be able to contribute.
Oh, wonderful.
Paul, that's incredible. Thank you so much. That's a lovely contribution. Thank you, Paul Theron. And the team at Vestact, Managing Director at Vestact this evening, 25 grand. Ka-ching. There we go, Graham.
Wonderful.
You planted a seed. And it is fertilized and is growing. Vestact and Adrian Saville coming to the party on that one. Last one, I mean, African Rand were capital coming under a bit of pressure. They've invested heavily in the South African economy. But what's most interesting to me, just because I'm watching this closely, is a 12 billion rand valuation being placed on Rain, on wireless broadband company, which is coming in to challenge the existing players.
Yeah, Bruce, I think, and that might be why the share is trading at less than half its net asset value. Some people don't trust that valuation. I'm a RAIN subscriber, so we've, for example, got that as a backup in our office to the fiber for when that periodically goes down. And it's a fantastic service. It's cost effective. So I believe that that they are going to eat the lunch of the incumbents. Whether a 12 billion rand valuation is right or not, I don't know. But I think the point is that they have got an incredible array of businesses in there. Sort of a lot of them very much focused on disruptive technologies, things like green energy, lots of interesting financial services companies. And, you know, for people who want to back a collection of very good jockeys, believe in the power of balance sheet and believe in the deal making ability of people like Patrice Motsepe, I think this is a one to, it's a bit of a flutter, it's early days. But I think this company has an incredible opportunity to capitalize on the disruption that's going to take place in financial services and elsewhere. And for people with a higher risk appetite, you can buy this one and maybe it turns out to be, you know, the Rembrandt that Anton Rupert used to sort of hawk around. I think it's a very, very exciting business, but it's not for widows and orphans.
No, it's not. There is risk, but with that potentially comes reward. Very quickly, Graham, where can anybody who wants to find out more about your project for the Financial Services Challenge, where give me one place they can go?
FinServe. So Fin, abbreviation for Financial, Serve for Good, the number 4, good.co.za. And failing that, just Google me and you can phone me if you're battling.
There we go. Graham Koerner with the Koerner Perspective this evening. Thank you, Graham Koerner. And hey, it was worthwhile taking the drive in tonight. Some nice money coming through for Food and Trees for Africa. finservefogood.co.za, the project that is raising money to plant trees in areas that need trees.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
Now, those horrific crime stats today, and it does make us look like we're at war with one another. More than 21,000 people killed by others to the highest level since the early 2000s. That's 58 people a day. Just picture that. I mean, just imagine the faces of 58 people that you know. This is grotesque, and I'm sorry, but just get a sense of it. And that happens every day. More people died violently in South Africa last year than in Syria, which is in the grips of a civil war. The Western Cape is disproportionately affected. Nearly 19% of all murders in South Africa happen in the Western Cape. The province only accounts for fewer than 12% of the population, so it's massively disproportionate. 11 Western Cape police stations are recorded amongst the top 30 in the country. Now, here's an interesting idea from Andrew Fall, who is a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies, ISS. And he's pointed out today that 70% of murders in South Africa happen Friday to Monday. And he's found that not only do they happen Friday to Monday, but they are primarily concentrated in particular areas. And his view is we can turn the tide if there's intentional, targeted policing, violence prevention interventions. And there you would include social workers going in there, drugs experts going in there, experts of every kind going into these riddled areas, which must be hell to live in, and beginning real projects to help alleviate the burden of death in these areas. It must be awful living in these areas. And there's a saying, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And we are measuring it, but we're not managing it. And we know the biggest issues. We know where they happen. We know almost to the day when they happen. Surely now, based on that, we can start to manage it. Surely or not. Coming up on your next Money Show, the very latest in the saga involving Old Mutual's board and its former chief executive, Peter Moyo, the chairman, Trevor Manuel, breaking his silence on Friday. He looks forward to joining you on the Money Show on Friday night. We'll do our best to get him in studio. Plus, we'll play the Brutal Biz quiz. And of course, we'll bring you highlights from the week that has been on the Money Show in our regular Best Bits feature. All of that. Plus, of course, what's happening on markets, which have had a very good week. A very, very good week.
702. Bruce is on the Money Show.
Spur managed to grow profits 10% for the year to the end of June, which in the environment in which we're in, with revenues up by less than 6%, is pretty good going. But South Africa's a tough place to be. But there's a part of the world they're finding even harder going, and we'll talk about that in just a bit. Pierre Fontaine is the chief executive of Spur Corporation. It owns a bunch of brands. Of course, the core Spur brand is in there. It also owns Nikos Cold Grill Greek. It owns Rocamamas nowadays, a big stake in that. It also, talk about steaks, in Hussar Grill, and of course Panarotti's Pizza too. Let's go through it bit by bit if we can, Pierre Fontaine. Your South African restaurants generally do seem to be taking strain. How are you holding up in the South African restaurant space?
Bruce, it's by no means sort of easy. It's a very difficult situation to be in because discretionary spend is definitely under pressure. The escalation of costs in households and so forth has limited what I would call a discretionary spend or a privileged spend in restaurants. So it hasn't been difficult, but at the same time, we've sort of counteracted that by driving big value food in terms of freshness, presentation, look and feel. You know, people don't actually want to stay at home and get cabin fever all the time by ordering Mr. Delivery. So I think, you know, to get people out of their homes into the restaurants today, especially in the economic times of today, is a challenge.
I mean, you talk about Mr. Delivery. How significant is the existence of Uber Eats and Mr. Delivery in your world?
Very much so. They play a role there. We would be naive to say that we don't view that as a real strategic threat going forward because of the convenience factor. But, you know, if you have some counter-intuitive, what I will call strategies to balance the books, I mean, they are there for convenience. People will use them for convenience. People's lifestyles today are different. And if you don't play in that game and you don't play in that field, you'll be caught left wanting.
I mean, is it really the future, though? I mean, we see Naspers investing aggressively in these food delivery services all over the world, including in Mr. D. And I just, a soggy burger with cold onion rings and chips that were made, you know, 20 minutes ago is, again, maybe it's a millennial thing, but it's not my thing. There is a popularity to these things, despite the fact that the food doesn't arrive as it does in the restaurant.
Well, me and you, Bruce.
Yeah, exactly. Us. You know?
You know, there's certain products that travel well, and I would call a pizza that can travel well, a sushi can travel well, and so forth. But there are certain products that don't travel well, and at the end of the day, I think you will find as you go forward that the range of products, as I call them, will be limited to those that can travel and can get into your home in a reasonable state. I don't believe currently where everything suits everybody to order anything on the menu, et cetera, is sustainable. It's a margin erosion for especially independents. I think the brands can handle it slightly better. I do see that it is part and parcel of the future, but I do see a limited menu coming out in that area.
You know, I mean, the pizza is such an interesting category because it was growing, and it sort of seems to have hit a pizza plateau, if you like. I mean, your pizza business is struggling. Is that an industry-wide problem, or has Panarotti's got a design flaw?
No, I think it's an industry-wide problem. If you look at today, if you look at the discounting of what I would call restaurant food, I mean, pizza must be right up there with all of them in terms of not giving their food away. It's not the right phraseology, but I think discounting your product and so forth, as you well know, we've been there. I think that's a short-term euphoria type of thing to get turnover, but long-term sustainability from a business perspective, not good. So I think the pizza operations are going to pan out, so to speak. I think the guys who, again, there are some great independents, there are some great sort of what I would call brands out there. We have certain ideas and certain strategies that we have in place, again, to drive that value of the pizza and the quality of the pizza and the imported flour and so forth. So, and people are, you know, whilst the discretionary spend might be under a lot of strain, people are very, very, very particular today in terms of what products they choose and what they eat and how fresh it is and traceability and so forth.
When you look at it in terms of Rocker Mamas is a concept that's going down well in South Africa. It's very popular. It's a burger concept, of course, but it differentiates itself in many ways from Spur. You're opening in India and Cyprus. The globalization of brands, you sort of flex and you try different things all the time. India and Cyprus for Rocker Mamas?
Again, Bruce, we, as I've said to you before, we do not go to a country. I mean, we've closed Malawi, we've closed Uganda. We don't go to territories where there's only a possibility or there is no possibility going forward of growing it to 5 or 10, because you, as a brand, you need to get to that critical mass. And we have got great franchisees in Cyprus, and we've got great franchisees in India who have the, I suppose, to be quite blunt, have the pockets, to carry a brand and build a brand. I mean, we can't wait to get to Mumbai and so forth. And, I mean, India in itself is a huge, huge market. Although the products are slightly different, we've tuned our products to the local taste profile. And Cyprus is, it's like a restaurant mecca there as well.
What's not working is Australia and New Zealand. It was the logic that so many of your 90s and noughties customers are in Australia and New Zealand nowadays that you better send a Spur to go and service them. The problem is running a Spur in those markets is fiendishly expensive. I mean, operating costs must have gone through the roof.
Bruce, we've made a decision that firstly, we have people who have put their life savings into those two territories in terms of building Spurs and Panarottis. We've gone under master license or license agreements. So we have a guy on the ground who looks after them, who is no cost to us. But the most important thing to shareholders and to the analysts and so forth, as we said to them today, is that we will be investing no more money into New Zealand or Australia. We will have some carrying costs, but they're not material within our biggest scheme of things. So what I'm saying to you is that we are winding the operation down ever so slightly.
Winding it down ever so slightly, but I mean, if it continues in Australia and New Zealand, it continues at the master franchisee's risk. You're not putting any more money into it. They're going to have to stump up the cash if they want to keep it going.
Correct, but I mean, I think if you look at our current businesses in New Zealand and Australia, they are well-run stores, although they're far apart from Western Australia to New South Wales to Auckland. I do think that we have some very strong operators there, and their independence and how they look after their businesses is exemplary. So, plus they'll have the support of the local, there's a guy in Australia who's been there for 23 years and used to work for us. So they will have the support, which is the most important thing in terms of franchising.
Pierre van Dorner, thank you. The Chief Executive of Spur Corporation, and Hassan Grill also doing very nicely. It's a tough environment. And it's so interesting, isn't it, that these food delivery businesses are very useful. Lots of you use them. We've tested them on the show. Some came up better than others. But not everything is deliverable. Some stuff is just horrendous, 10 minutes after it comes out of the oven, off the grill, or whatever the case might be. And the future of that particular market is going to be really interesting.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
I see Mr. Price has suspended two senior managers. Executive, they say that two members of senior management and a single supplier, there's been an allegation of non-compliance with the Mr. Price Code of Conduct. What's that? Procurement fraud? Something. Anyway, in accordance with the company's standard procedures, these employees be placed on precautionary suspension. So Mr. Price finding out that senior managers are allegedly up to no good and taking action, which I suppose is good. How often do you hear something on the radio that you fundamentally disagree with, a commercial message of some kind, and you just go, I don't like the way they're phrasing it, I don't like what they're saying. What they're saying is inaccurate, or what they're saying is factually wrong. You can, like, you know, shake your head and mutter and tut about it. You can demonstrate that it's wrong, but you're not going to tackle it head on. It's a bit too much of a mission. You might just get irritated until next time you hear it, and then by the next time you're driven over the edge and you don't know what to do. Well, Stefan Marnowick has heard something on the radio that really annoyed him, and so he decided to take action. Stefan, tell us what you did.
Good evening, Bruce, and to your listeners. Yes, Bruce, I'm a commuter between Pretoria and Johannesburg. And I heard multiple times in very expensive marketing slots in the morning on the radio, the various radio shows, heard the advert of the Gautrain, where the guys were claiming that you could add time to your life. And they were using factual numbers, supposedly from a very specific research company that was done. And they were claiming that you could gain up to 11 days by making use of their services.
No, I get that. I mean, I get that. I mean, you can either sit on the highway for 4 hours a day there and back, or you can jump onto the Gautrain and you can be, you know, at your destination within half an hour, for argument's sake. That's a saving every day of 3.5 hours. That adds 11 days to your life, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. I was sitting in my car listening to that radio advert over and over, and the numbers just doesn't stack up. I see lots of commuters on the Gautrain, but they use the train every day. They're not in a position where they can take 11 days off and spend it with their family or their loved ones. They just can't. They're in the train every single day, the same as other road commuters and users. It's as simple as that. That advert was just factually flawed and incorrect.
So what did you do about it? What did you do?
So I took it to the Advertising Regulatory Board of South Africa. They've got a fantastic online system. I logged the claim, listed my complaint. Gave a little bit of detail around the advertisement, and the guys did an investigation. And I must say, I was very pleased with the efficiency that it was run, and it's heartening to know that there's some organizations out there in South Africa that still operates efficiently and serving the community well.
Did they say to you, oh, Stefan, stop being so pedantic? It's obviously an advertising message. Of course you can't add time to your life. You're saving time. It's merely an expression which illustrates how much more efficient traveling by train is than angry Stefan sitting in his car stewing away in the traffic. Or did they uphold it?
No, they were very accommodating, and they took on the case and they listened. They obviously gave the Gautrain guys an opportunity to respond to it as well, which they did. But the method, Bruce, is quite simple. It's a principal discussion, this. And how far can you stretch the truth or the in-truth or of your marketing message? You know, there's a factual line, and I think they crossed it.
I'm sorry, I've been watching the Zondo Commission. I think you can stretch the truth to wherever you like, but you're talking about advertising specifically.
It could go a long way, yes.
No, but Stefan, I mean, you stood up for what you see as dishonest, and thank you for sharing it with us. Stefan Marnowick, he is a retail chief financial officer. He is a man who's big on details, and he listened to the advert, and he went, that's not factually true. So he took it to the regulator of advertising in South Africa, and they agreed with him. And so Gautrain's been told you can't play those adverts anymore. The respondent indicated it would change the campaign. However, it has not given the directorate an unequivocal undertaking. It will not use the claims complained against it in future. That's interesting. I mean, they're going to find a cunning way around it, get a better copywriter, obviously, to get the nuance of those 11 days, no doubt, done. But Stefan Marnowick, as you can, if something really bugs you, stood up for himself and went, no, don't think so. And he got agreement.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
So these crime stats stories that are terrifying. They're absolutely awful. But I take a lot of comfort from the fact that we're getting a very good handle on crime statistics. There was a time where nobody believed the crime stats, and they seem to be more reliable now. One of the ones that, I mean, the best lesson today from these crime statistics is the fact that the stuff that happens in social media world, political agendas, they're toxic bedmates. They really are. And I don't mean to play down the crime stats one little bit. One murder is one murder too many. But the idea of farm murders, and we've seen the hype around farm murders, and we've seen the AfriForums going to the White House and have photographs of them taken with advisors to Donald Trump. And we've seen that dreadful woman in the UK. What's her name? She's a columnist, and she Hopkins. Oh, dreadful. Dreadful. And fighting some sort of vigilante online battle for white South Africans, and there's going to be a genocide and all of this sort of stuff. And 2017, 2018, so last year's crime stats, 62 out of the 20,336 murders. I mean, I can't even begin to comprehend. Do you know 20,000 people? I don't think you do. But 62, so 0.3% of all murders committed in South Africa were farm attacks. And that's 62 farm murders, too many. But this last year, 47 of a bigger number, 21,022 murders, were farm murders, which means that from 0.3% of all murders, it's down to 0.22% of all murders. Still too many. And so there's no white genocide. White farmers aren't the targets of murder in South Africa. That's not what the statistics show. They're victims, and they shouldn't be attacked, but they, you know, crime affects everybody. And we live in a violent country. Murder is up, rape is up, robbery is up. Cash and transit are down, carjackings are down, drug-related arrests are down, and that's perhaps because Dach has been legalized for personal use, maybe. Or maybe the cops just aren't much good at it or have given up, I don't know. But it's some interesting sort of analysis is required, and far smarter people than I who understand these stats are going to be doing it in the next couple of days. But it is encouraging when you get away from the rough of social media stuff and the nonsense of social media, and you just get perspective when you get data. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And the observation from the Institute for Security Studies today is showing that most murders are happening, 70% of murders between Friday night and Saturday and Sunday night, and they're happening in a dense concentration of police areas. It shows that if you target your policing effectively and your social programs effectively, you can dramatically reduce the effects of violent crime in South Africa.
702. Bruce is on The Money Show.
So last night, our shapeshifter Modula Mofolo from Summer Place Equity Partners talked to us about Cool Kids Cabs, and they were the winners of the 702 Small Business Awards in 2015. And they've just received a big wad of cash from the SASME fund allocation that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, that money being channeled through Summer Place Equity Partners. Summer Place then identified Cool Kids Cabs, and they are a beneficiary of this money. Tiffany Hine is the founder of Cool Kids Cabs, on the line to us from Midrand this evening. When you entered the competition, the Small Business Awards in 2015, so 4 years ago now, Tiffany, how well established were you?
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. Thanks. It's so great to be back on 702 again. So we were still struggling to find our feet, I think, in many respects. We were so grateful for the opportunity at the time because we were nominated by one of our clients, and it felt like such a feather in our cap that our service was being appreciated by our clients. I think at the time we had about 10 vehicles on the road. Maybe a little bit more. I'm just trying to think back. But about 10 vehicles on the road. And we certainly weren't at the fleet numbers or the employment numbers that we are today. So it seems like a bit of a lifetime ago.
Okay, it is. It's 4 years. I mean, it's been a hard slog, no doubt. What sort of presence have you got now? I mean, you've grown over time, and you've just recently had a nice cash injection as well. Tell me the story since then.
Yeah, so I think since our winning at 702, we were certainly approached by a number of investors along the way. And to be honest, none of them really felt like the right fit for us. We've been passionate about women empowerment and been passionate about what we offer for so long. It seemed like a bit of a cop-out to take the wrong partner in, even if the money were available. So when Summer Place approached us last year, I was quite forthcoming about my space and my positioning around looking for investors, given the track record that I'd had. But I think Modula summed it up. She said that Summer Place was created, the name was because they want to be seen as warm, feminine, and aspirational. And I certainly feel for us that's how we've experienced them as investors, and it's been a great fit for the brand.
So where does it take you then? I mean, I forget the exact number. I think it was 10 million rand that they've been able to apportion to you. It's a substantial amount of capital into a business.
It is, yeah. And it's been wonderful. It's given us the opportunity to expand into a number of things that we were so desperate to do historically but weren't able to do because we weren't able to get funding for. So, for instance, we launched the Big Yellow Bus, which is the only bus in South Africa that can install car seats onto every one of the seats. So scholar transport now is accessible in a safe manner to schools. So schools are able to hire that vehicle out now and put little children into buses with the correct child restraints, which is not something that's been available on the market historically. And so that's been a really exciting development. And then as Madula also mentioned last night, the introduction of our app, which is in final testing phase at the moment, and will be launched early October, has also been enabled through this investment. We've been able to go full tilt with that development, which is really going to take us to new heights, and we're super excited about that.
Do you see the scalability? Do you see the options of actually growing this business beyond yourselves? Is it a franchise opportunity? What do you see as the great goal here?
Yeah. Listen, the great goal is definitely to take this into all other provinces and certainly look at even further expansion than that. Whether it goes into a franchise model or not, I'm not certain at this point. It doesn't seem likely. We love the idea of maintaining some of the personalization and controls that we have, but I certainly am not closed to opportunities at this point. And I feel like I've got the right partners alongside me now to be able to make those decisions going forward into the future.
It's a lovely story, Tiffany. Well done. Tiffany Hine is the founder at Cool Kids Cabs, winner of the 2015 Small Business Awards. And again, it shows the impact of the Small Business Awards, and that's brilliant. But it, more than anything else, it shows her tenacity, her independence, her fierce independence. People came to her and said, here's some money. And she said, no, don't want your money. It's going to compromise the goal. And so she had very clear ambitions for what she wanted to do. And then the right funder comes along, and she goes, yeah, okay. And the last person I met who was like that was Custer Semenya, and she was speaking at a big conference last year, Discovery just come on as her a key sponsor of hers, and she went, people come to me all the time and want to sponsor me. I go, no, it doesn't fit, it doesn't work for me, I don't relate to what they're doing. And these guys came along, and it was the right fit, so I agreed. And it's like really an intense focus on understanding yourself, your business, your brand, your business's brand, and understanding what does and doesn't work. If you make bad choices, especially in your build phase, you can kill your small business. What are the seven things that upset Alon Reyes, the founder of Reyes Corp, most about the small business environment? He sent me a WhatsApp this week saying, what do you want me to talk about? And so it was between things. I went, I'm interested to rile him. So let's see what irritates him. And so he sent me a list of seven things, and they are good seven things. Irritating things. One of them I don't understand, but six out of the seven are irritating things. We'll talk to him about those in a bit.
The Money Show. Personal finance.
So, have you recently bought a unit trust? If you bought a unit trust, how did you choose that unit trust? And I'm really, it's a serious question. Did you sort of go, eeny, meeny, I don't know. Most of us would ask a friend and say, like, what have you invested in? Well, maybe you'd have a friend who's a financial advisor. You say, what should I invest in? And how does the financial advisor or the friend choose their unit trust? And I would suggest that many people go, well, let's see what did well last year. Let's see what did well the year before and the year before that. And let's see if there's any consistency. But last year, the guys who were hot last year, they've got to be hot this year. That's a good strategy, right, Warren Ingram, from Galileo Capital?
No, it's a terrible strategy. And it's even worse when people look at it and say, so currently if we look at what's going on in the South African unit trust space, it's almost clear that over 1, 3, 5 years, and I haven't looked at 6-year numbers, but those don't generally get published as often, but over 1, 3, and 5, most likely the best performing unit trust in those time frames is something that was generating interest. They would either be a money market fund or an income fund. And I don't want to name it because then everyone's going to go and buy it at possibly the worst possible time. So they're looking at that now and saying, gee, if I had moved my money from this balanced fund and I'd put it into this income fund.
Because balanced fund at best have been giving you 5% a year, at best,
yeah,
in recent years.
Yeah. And so, I should have had all my money in there. Why don't we do a switch now and let's put it into this income fund? It's delivering 8%. I mean, 8%, that's like double nearly what the balanced funds are giving. Let's just do that. And the world's uncertain. We should just do that. Why don't we? That's a great strategy. And that conversation one hears more and more and more right now. And I can understand it much more than I could in the past, because any decent advisor would say to you, look, 5 years is a decent investment period. over 5 years.
Hold on, let me just go onto my JSE app over here. Oh, look, the JSE has given you nothing in 5 years, Warren.
and so I understand investors who might have trusted their advisor over the last 5 years and by now are starting to say to themselves, hang on, you know, you said long-term starts at 5 years and actually, you know, my JSE investment or my balanced fund, because I think most of the world ends up somehow in a mix, you know, mix of assets like a balanced fund, that they're not even beating inflation. So, sorry, you know, I don't really buy your argument anymore. You've lost credibility with me and I want to go into an income fund. And that's generally what happens. So either they choose the best fund in a particular category, but I think that's even a bit too scientific for what generally happens. Most of the time, people just look at what is the best performer they can find, and often it might be advertised. That's the scary part about this. Or,
well, I mean, again, this is a marketing game. I mean, if you're in the investment markets, investments are sold, not bought. So financial advisors go to in conferences and to meetings, and they meet the fund managers, and the fund managers generally are quite warm, personable people, and they're smart, and they tell a good story, and the ones that performed well last year, say I had the best performing unit trust last year, we had this amount of inflows and we're applying it in this way, this is the way we're going to do it into the future, and they go gobble gobble gobble, yes please, and then they go and sell their clients into those funds, and sometimes they get lucky, but I mean, based on history you investing rather than based on what, because I don't know how else you choose a great unit trust for the long term if you're not judging past performance.
So I think it's silly to disregard past performance altogether. I think that's a mistake that people make in the investment world, but they should use past performance as one of a few criteria, not just the only criteria. And I think that's the sad part about this. But if someone's sitting with me and saying, okay, how could I choose a unit trust? You know, write me like a five-pointer or whatever, you know, guidelines for how I can choose a unit trust. I think the first thing is, you know, this is not like a marriage. In this instance, it is all about you. It starts with you first and what's important for you with this investment decision, and then from there you go. In other words, it starts with what do you need this money for? And when do you need it? So if you need this money to be part of your long-term savings and so, you know, I mean, as we've established, 5 years and longer, then that's an important criteria, because it means you can afford, from a time point of view, you can afford to take some risk. In other words, you can afford to have some or most of the money in shares and in property. So that's an important criteria. The second thing will be, you know, if we've got the time frame sorted out, then the second thing will be your innate tolerance for risk. As a human being, what sort of investment risk are you comfortable to deal with? Very hard thing to quantify. It's an extremely difficult conversation to have, because if you're starting out with investments, you don't know. And secondly, no human being likes to lose money. So,
and also, I don't know if they still do it, but I mean, if you go to financial advisors and they give you a test to test your risk tolerance, and you'd ask questions, and then you try and game the game, because you don't want to look stupid, so you start answering questions in a way that makes you look clever. And that doesn't give you a real risk tolerance at all.
No, and I mean, I can tell you, when I started in the industry, and that, you know, it was only a year or two ago, maybe in the 90s, the questions used to ask things, one of the questions would be something like, do you participate in adrenaline sports? You know, do you do bungee jumping? Or do you, as if somehow your tolerance for personal safety relates to your tolerance for investment risk.
And it's also the world's worst question, because, I mean, bungee jumping relative to horse riding, I'm sure, is considerably safer.
Yeah,
you know, because the people,
at least you've got a rope attached.
You've got a rope attached to you, and a horse thinks for itself, and if it doesn't like you, you're going to end up on your face.
Yeah.
So, you know, bungee jumping is probably a very safe thing. Yet it's deemed to be dangerous. Therefore, you like adrenaline. Therefore, you like high risk. Therefore, we're going to put you into some
small company funds in Southeast Asia.
Small company Bitcoin traders in Southeast Asia.
Yeah. So the thing there is that a good risk tolerance tool nowadays, there more and more of them have been developed over time, and they've actually started to involve proper psychometric tests. And so your comment there is right there. Don't now try and fool somebody else, because all that's happening in that situation is you're going to compromise the advice that you're going to be given, and that's not a good outcome. You're not fooling anybody except yourself.
But I know that if I'm only putting away R1,000 a month and I'm not going to have enough for retirement, so I want to take more risk. I want to be seen as somebody who can tolerate higher risk. So therefore, I'm going to go and fib on the test to make the advisor think that I'm a high risk candidate, yep. because otherwise they're going to put me into an income fund and I'm only going to make 7 or 8% a year, and that's not going to grow my money fast enough. And actually, I'm quite greedy, and I just want to make as much as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and I mean, what a fabulous way to make terrible investment decisions.
Yeah, yeah, but I think people do this kind of thing.
And I think that's the sad part, is that I think in something like this, you know, a level of honesty, at least with yourself, in exercise like this is important, because the thing about risk tolerance is everything's fine until it's not. And so when you go through a big market drop like we saw in 2008, which from a drop point of view was a very big drop, but the recovery was very quick, you won't participate in that recovery if you actually have a low tolerance for risk, but you fibbed to yourself or to your advisor and you participate in the loss. What happens is your instinct and your individual inbuilt drive will kick in. No matter what you do, it's hardwired in you. What will happen is you will at some point send a sell instruction either to the unit trust company directly or to your advisor, and there will be no discussion or negotiation. It will be an instruction: get out. And then the advisor will be saying, if it's a decent advisor, hang on, you know, just stick it out. And there won't be a debate. It will just be sheer panic, and you're going to tell them to get out possibly the day before the market turns, because as a human race, that's what we do. We've seen this hundreds of times over now. So I think the thing there is to try and understand that. The third criteria when you're making these unit trust selections is your financial ability to deal with risk. In other words, if you're 25 and you're saving 1,000 rand a month and you've got a long period of time to go before you're going to need this money, and you've got the tolerance sorted out and you understand, you know, what's going on here, fine. Then do it. But if this is money that you need in a year's time, because that's when you're going to retire, then even if you've got a high tolerance for risk, but you might start to need the income from this, then you need to review your position. So your financial position is important, and it's probably as important as your tolerance for risk and the time frame that you're going to invest the money. That's the starting point for making a unit trust selection. What it will do is it will give you the category of unit trust you should be looking at. In other words, should it be pure shares? Very few people should have all their money in only in shares. It's actually a very small percentage of the world's population. So most of the time, it's going to be some kind of a balanced portfolio. It could be they're called the moderate funds or conservative funds, where you've got some exposure to shares, but it's quite a low exposure. Or it's going to be the balanced funds or something in between. Very few people should have all their money in cash or all their money in an income fund, even if that was the best category for the last year or two. And I'd probably say, especially if it was the best category for the last year or two, you definitely shouldn't have all your money in money market or fixed income or income funds.
Because but if you told me that 3 years ago, then because you don't put the money in the best category of the last 2 years, I wouldn't have put it into money market funds. And money market funds have continued to outperform for the next 3 years. So
that for the last 3 years.
From that point.
Yeah.
So none of this is set in stone. So I still don't know how to choose a unit trust.
I mean, we're nearly there, aren't we?
I hope so.
So then once we've got those categories, then to look at past performance is not a bad idea in that fund's category. So let's just stay with balanced funds because it's an easy one.
Yep.
So you would say, okay, let's judge this balanced fund in comparison to its universe. What have other balanced funds done in over a longish period of time? Don't go and look at the last 1, 2, and 3 years, because that frankly could be down to luck. So what you want to see is, does this fund deliver consistent performance? Is it in the top half at the very least, preferably in the top 25% of its performers and in its benchmark over 5, 10, 15 years? Important point here. I'm not really that interested in a fund that's only 1 or 2 or 3 years old, because it's not showing me a history of being able to deliver.
What did they do when things went pear-shaped? How did they behave? And is it the same person who's managing that money today as was managing it 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago?
And I think that's the fact of the industry is that I'm pretty interested in companies and funds that have been around for a long period of time, and particularly where the founding group have retired, they've passed on their knowledge to the next group, and those people have implemented the philosophies and the approach in the same way as the past, and they've managed to do it consistently. Where that founder, is, let's say, elderly now, and that founder disappears, we have no guarantee that knowledge will move on. So it does work against the newer entrants. That is the sad thing. But what I would say is, if you're struggling to make this decision and you've decided balanced funds is your thing, history tells you you're probably better off choosing this year's worst performer for the next 5 years than this year's best performer. That's really the bottom line in this whole thing is actually
choosing. But don't go and choose this year's worst performer, because maybe on its way out. I mean, the fund worst manager performer. May have gone. Yes, the fund manager may have gone crazy. Again, understand it's the worst performer. Understand why it's the worst performer. Why did it do bad? Did you understand why they were buying property shares when property shares were on a steady decline? Do you understand what they're thinking? I mean, this starts getting really complicated. So you go to a financial advisor who went to lunch with the fund manager, and they say buy this, and you go okay then, because that's rough. That's actually what most people do.
And it's time to start asking questions, and it's time to start getting behind that first level of answer from the advisor or from whatever you've read or whatever it is that you're following, because that's not a good enough answer anymore. You know, just
I went to the presentation, we had lunch, and it was such a nice chap. So clever.
And that, you know, that fund manager is telling me about all these wonderful things he wants to buy or has bought in his fund. That's not good enough either. But don't shy away from bad performers now. I think that some of the best fund managers in this country and actually in the world, Warren Buffett's a good example of this. I mean, he is a fund manager. And right now, they're not delivering great returns because the markets are skewed. Things are strange at the moment. But watch the next 5 years, and I bet you class is permanent, and I think that's what happens now. The classy managers start to deliver again when the world gets difficult, which is what it must be. The definition. And so now is not the time just to chop and change. If your potentially great fund that you've had that's been run by great managers is just near the bottom of the rankings, that may be, in a funny way, should be a source of comfort for you now.
Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital. How to choose a unit trust. It's a complicated thing. There are 1,000-something of these things. There are lots of them. And then you go into the exchange-traded funds place, and there are hundreds of them now, too. It's becoming a very, very crowded marketplace. Alon Reyes is here. We'll talk to him in a few moments' time. But first, very latest eyewitness news. Fisor Zulu, what's happening in the world?
The Money Show. Small business.
So, Alon Reyes, the chief executive of Reyes Corp, in studio with us this evening. The 7 things that make Alon Reyes most grumpy about entrepreneurship. I didn't think you could possibly be grumpy about entrepreneurship. This is your lifeblood. This is your oxygen. This is your everything. This is the thing that makes you get up in the morning. How can you be grumpy about anything to do with this wonderful world of entrepreneurship, Alon Reyes?
Well, Bruce, you did ask me to list the things that are making me grumpy. So, I did, and I have grumpy things to say.
Okay, number one on your list, and I love this one, because this idea that, you know what, South Africa's got an unemployment crisis. You know what we need to do? We need people to go and create their own businesses. People must start out and build their own businesses, because if they build their own businesses, they can employ other people. And if you just one person and you create business and employs 10 people, you then change the world. And it's so nice for somebody who has never created a business to go cuckoo and make that as a suggestion, because it's blimmin' hard.
Yes, Bruce. So we, in my opinion, we've glamorized entrepreneurship way too much. We've gone too far, in my opinion. If you look at the research, you'll see that if you take somebody who has a corporate position with a certain set of skills and somebody who starts a business with the same set of skills, over the lifetime of the two people, the corporate person will make more money on average. Entrepreneurship tends to be we see in the press all the positive stories. We don't hear about all the negative stories. And I think what happens when we glamorize entrepreneurship too much is that our expectations about the journey are not set properly, and we don't expect it to be that hard, because government has sold us that, you know, entrepreneurs are 2-minute noodles. On Friday, we are unemployed youth. On Saturday and Sunday, we go on a course. We get a business in a box. And on Monday, we're an entrepreneur. And that, of course, has a massive, massive failure rate, and people's lives are damaged and their confidence is damaged. So in my opinion, entrepreneurship needs to come with a warning sign. It's as we've heard before, it's not for sissies, but it also can be incredibly damaging. So I think we need to go into this with eyes wide open and with a sober understanding of what it takes.
But if you tell people it's hard, nobody's going to want to do it. So if you lie to people about it and more people try, you're likely to have a higher success rate.
Well,
maybe.
That sounds good at the top, but the problem is that people then get themselves into all sorts of trouble and into debt. And if they have not been prepared enough for the journey, if they aren't exactly what is required as an entrepreneur right now on their life's journey, then it can be more damaging than positive. And unfortunately, this is something I hate to say as a proponent for entrepreneurship, but it technically it damages more than it creates positive in many situations.
I mean, it's natural to tell the positive stories. It's natural to tell the story of Brian Joffe starting Bidvest and starting with very little, and Adrian Gore arriving, you know, at RMB and saying, I've got an idea, how about you back me? And they did, and look at the success. It's great to look at the startup stories of just so many great South African entrepreneurs, whether it be the Lubners or whether it be the Morkels or whoever it might be, over many, many years. And you go, look at these great success stories. If we told stories about the failures, people who went in and families fell apart and people committed suicide and they lost everything and they ended up on the bare bones of their backside, nobody would ever go into the water.
Or maybe just the people who are prepared to take the risk are. Because if you look at the stats, 96% of small businesses will fail in a 10-year period, most of them in the first 2 years. And of that, 90% just give up. And they give up generally within the first 3 years. So in those first 3 years, we have undertaken that debt. I've left all sorts of other opportunities. We have to just be very sober. I'm not saying don't follow. I'm a big proponent of entrepreneurship. Don't get me wrong. No. But what I'm saying is that you've got to go in it eyes wide open with a sober understanding of what it takes, both from you, from a sacrifice for your family, sacrifice for your health, sacrifice with your friends. It's an incredibly sacrificial journey to go on, and many people don't want to go on that journey and talk about life-work balance, where if you are going to, in my opinion, going to be successful, your first 3 to 5 years cannot even entertain that kind of thought.
And that's something also that people don't want to consider when they go into this, because the idea of being their own boss, the idea of sleeping late and playing golf 3 times a week is far more appealing than work.
Yeah, I've never met those particular entrepreneurs. I see it in magazines. I certainly, you know, there are certain people after a certain journey, and of course there are those success stories, the exceptions, but by far the majority, I mean, I've worked with over 13,000 small businesses over the last 19 years, and my experience tells a different story, that it's much more hard work than golf and lunches and boozy afternoon drinks looking at the sun go down.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's not like that. Pivoting for pivot's sake. Explain this one to me, please. I mean, you come up with a great idea, and suddenly 2 years later, this guy's tried 20 different things. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. So you know, in entrepreneurship, there's always some words. There's product market fit. There's always some sort of newfangled terminology. The terminology that I've been hearing a lot over the last couple of years is this concept of pivoting. And although I strongly believe that pivoting is required, I think what's happened is that pivoting has been misunderstood.
Just define pivoting, if you would.
Okay. So pivoting, in my understanding of what pivoting is that you go along a journey that you have this certain idea, and then the market gives you feedback, and then you adjust your trajectory, and you go in a different trajectory to the one that you initially started, and then you would get more market feedback, and then you would pivot again, you would change your trajectory again based on the new information. So that was what pivoting is about, or you might emphasize one part of the business over another, and when you started you didn't believe that was the way that you were going to go. So that's what pivoting, I think, is meant to be. However, what it has become is actually a euphemism for reset. So like it's difficult. It's really, really hard, you know. So then I go Control Alt Delete and I start again. And I see, particularly with young entrepreneurs, every time it gets difficult, they say, it's difficult, I need to pivot. And then they go they go 90 degrees, they go in a completely...
Why do you use a Cape Town entrepreneur accent? Because that's what that one is.
Yes, you recognize it, all right?
I do. I was going to do a coffee shop, but like, cash is a big thing, so now I'm going to do that. But I'm going to surf first, yeah.
Because you need life work balance.
Exactly.
So what it's become is, in fact, a misnomer, is that a lot of people are talking about resetting or starting again versus the tweaking of the journey. And what I'm trying to emphasize to particularly young entrepreneurs is you don't, every time it gets difficult, you pivot, i.e. reset. You push through, you slightly adjust your trajectory, you keep reading information, and you keep pushing through until you get to the other side. There's more value in pushing through and tweaking than effectively taking a 90-degree turn every couple of months. Because you never build up any depth, you never build up any experience or credibility in that space, because you land up in a space that's completely different to where you started.
Okay. Now, I mean, everybody in the SMME sector. Ooh. What?
The what sector?
The SMME sector. That's what everybody calls it, except you.
Except me. You won't find me talking about SMMEs or SMEs.
Small and medium enterprises. That's what it stands for. Why is that so abhorrent?
Because if you look at, if you've been an entrepreneur and you've started off as a one-person operation and you've built a business, you would technically be at, when you're one person big, you would be a micro-business. And then you would grow and there'd be a couple of people, then there might be 10, and then you might be regarded as a small business and you'd grow to a medium-sized business when you're 100 or 200 people big. At each stage of that journey, you have different needs, completely different needs. In the beginning, you're thinking just about making month's end. You might need funding. When you are a medium-sized business, it's about management issues. It's about continuity. It's about a whole bunch of different issues that you have. When government creates policy that is under one banner called SMME policy, it misses the nuances in the market that pertain to small businesses, micro businesses, medium businesses that have slightly but importantly different needs. So the issue for me, and every time I travel the continent quite a bit, I meet with ministers, I beg them to change the term from SMME policy or SME policy to small business policy, micro business policy, medium business policy, that you have three different policies pertaining to the different stages of your growth.
Okay, I understand why it is that you find it so reprehensible. The next one, though, is one that we've chatted about before, but I'm still befuddled as to what is so deeply abhorrent about market days at school. I mean, we keep saying we need to teach kids about running small businesses and running small enterprises, and surely there's no better way than unleashing them on their fellow scholars, their fellow pupils at school, with either a brilliant idea or a terrible idea, and letting them go out there and make their own mistakes in a relatively safe environment.
Well, market days for me are, in the way that they are currently being conducted, are nowhere near what happens in real life. So if the intention of market day is to teach young people what is entrepreneurship, what it is like to run a business, well, I think they're missing the mark. In my experience, I have two kids who have gone through market days, and I've seen it with friends and the world over. It's about the most popular kid getting mommy and daddy to buy the products. Then they sell, the most popular kid sells the most products. The school retains all the cash. And none of that sounds like entrepreneurship to me, because in entrepreneurship, it's you that comes up with the idea. It's you that purchases the goods or manufactures the goods. It's your value that potentially, in your pricing, that will potentially sell better than somebody else, and you keep the money. And so there's this mismatch between what market day, I think, is intended to do and what it is really doing. And it's really sending the wrong signal to kids as to how business works.
At the same time, how do you do it better then? I mean, you know, if you're a charming kid, you've got personality on your side, you'll be good at sales. If you've got mom and dad, that's your network, so you tap into your network. And if you they then, you know, give you free stock, you're winning. What? Is that going to set you up for failure forever?
I don't know if it set you up for failure, but it will certainly give you the wrong impression of how it really works. So for me, if you were doing it in, if you were still running market day at a school, then I would say everyone has got, let's call it 200 rand to start off with, that everyone starts, it doesn't matter if mommy or daddy are rich or poor, it's 200 rand that you start off with, because then we can understand who's come up with the best product or service. Maybe it's 200 rand, maybe it's 500 rand. Whatever the number is. And then it's about you creating that, you pricing that correctly, you manufacturing that, you presenting that, you selling that, and then that would give you a better indication of whether your business is good or bad, and then you keep the money.
Now, I was reading something online. I can't remember who it was. I'd love to shame them because it was so painful. It was funny. And they were saying, so I got my kid an ice cream and I gave them the ice cream. Then I took it away and I took a big bite. I took 45% of the ice cream and I just chomped it and swallowed it because they need to learn about tax.
I read that as well.
I can't remember who did it, but it was just like this brutal parenting. Because, again, the brutal reality of if you are successful and you run a decent business, you are going to find yourself having to pay tax. It's not all yours. And that's a very hard thing to learn and teach, I suppose, via market day.
Well, then the school could tax and either provide a rental requirement for the stall to say that's your rent, you would normally pay rent, and we're going to charge you, 100 rand for the day, and that's where they make their money. Or they would take 30% or 42% or whatever the case may be of the retained earnings.
Yeah, and that wouldn't be a bad idea. But so what you're basically saying is you don't hate the idea that kids learn about entrepreneurship. You just want schools to be a little bit more
realistic,
inventive, and a bit more realistic about the way they do it. Business plans, I mean, many people are opposed to the idea of a business plan altogether. Do you hate them completely?
Well, Bruce, I've written a book called Lose the Business Plan. So I don't.
Yes, you have.
I don't. It's not about don't do the business plan. It's about don't use the business plan as a means to provide funding to people. Now, the banks, and there's a long story as to why banks actually use business plans, but business plans are by no ways an indicator of success. There is a 96% failure. At least 50% of those businesses are funded formally, and many of those, in fact, more than 95% of formal funding requires business plans. And of that, 96% still fails. So the business plan is, how can it be the right proxy for success? What is the right proxy for success is the entrepreneur's blue heart, their ability to stand up again and again, their flexibility, their ability to learn. It's about the entrepreneur or the entrepreneurial team that will determine success or failure, not this terrible thing called a business plan, which often is written by a third party who has little or no understanding of your business. And you do it only to get the funding from the bank, who then weigh it up and then say, okay, it's got that quality, let's give them the money or not.
We recorded a TV show for ENCA the other day, you and I, and I came to your school, which was your school which teaches kids about entrepreneurial mindsets. And the thing that has stuck in my brain more than anything else is the pitch patch, which is this raised deck in every single classroom. It's covered with AstroTurf, and kids have to pitch their ideas from that pitch patch to their classmates often. And it's just the most brilliant idea in terms of saying, okay, fine, you may not have a business plan, but at least learn how to communicate your ideas clearly, succinctly, in a way that people are prepared to listen to you. That blew my mind.
Yeah, a bit of low tech and the fact that you elevated and then you're practicing every day or at least 2-3 times a week, you're having to be in front of people talking about your ideas or what you've learned or, presenting. That is an incredibly important skill for entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs and everyone for that matter. So what we've seen just with this piece of low tech innovation that kids who were generally not speak at all, would be the wallflowers sitting quietly in the corner. When they get onto this inverted commas stage, a new person emerges. And after many years of doing that, their confidence is built and a completely different potential is unleashed.
Academics and their role when it comes to giving guidance and advice, particularly in the startup stage. I mean, they have a purpose, surely. I mean, lots of people write smart books on entrepreneurship and creating businesses and stuff. Do academics in your world have a role?
Yes, in universities. they're good there.
But so a lot of them sort of go, well, they need to make extra cash because academia doesn't really pay, and so they go into the consultancy game.
Yeah, and that'd be fine for big businesses, perhaps. But in my opinion, you know, it's not for small businesses. And I've seen this, and 2 weeks ago I went to look at buying a small consulting business that deals with small businesses. And they had a couple of these academics, and when I asked them, have you ever run a business before? They said no, but you know, they had a master's degree in finance or a master's degree in one in tax, but they'd never ever run a business before. And the issue there is that they don't have experience, number one, running the business, a small business, and what it really takes. They don't understand month end and the pain of month end, and therefore they don't have the real empathy which is important to move entrepreneurs. And there's a practicality gap that I see with generally with young academics. So my view is that they need to go out and start their own businesses and go through that journey to have that practical experience.
Have you ever been invited to be one of the dragons or the sharks?
I have.
Dragon's Den? And did you do it?
I did not.
But such a great opportunity. I mean, how much fun is it? I mean, isn't that the real cut and thrust? Of pitching and learning and getting ideas?
Well, in my opinion, it's very, very entertaining. You certainly can learn a lot. I do watch especially the American show. I find it very entertaining, and in fact, I learn from it too. But what it's done inadvertently is I have all these entrepreneurs, when they come to me, they sit down and they posture, and then they go, right, I'm going to allow you to buy 30% of my business for 3 million rand. That's not how it works. You know, sometimes you have to say hello first, you know, and then you know. So generally, what's happened is that they've distorted the understanding of how deals are done and how valuations are done, and so then you'd ask the individual, well, have you got any revenue? No, I've got no revenue. Have you got a track record? No track record. And they're valuing they've used a discounted cash flow model, and they've, you know, they give you all this jargon, but they've never ever run this business before, and they're valuing this business at 10 million or 20 million rand, and there's zero revenue. I'm a little old fashioned. To me, I like to see, unless I'm doing pure startup and then there's a different deal to be done, you know, to me, it doesn't work the way it does on TV. That's been my experience anyway.
Alon Reyes, for your list of things that irritate you, thank you very much for coming, and thank you for sharing them with us. They're very valuable insights this evening. The 7 things that make Alon Reyes most grumpy about entrepreneurship. Don't glamorize it. Don't pivot for pivot's sake. The term SMME, don't mention it in his space, in his area. He would get very cross with you. Market days at school don't work. They must be reworked. Business plans as a mean to funding, don't. Academics as consultants to small business, especially young academics. That was a particular point. Mm. And then don't believe that it's like it is on TV, because it's not. It's much, much harder. Thank you, Alon.